Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, August 27, 2019. Parents of a slain U.S. journalist want answers.
We've done bold things. Like even meeting our senator a year and a half ago felt bold. Going to the U.N. and meeting the person who reports directly to the Secretary General, that felt bold.
And a Washington Mandela Fellow opens a secondary school in Juba.
He believes that it's through education that he can achieve this. And I must tell you that the response of the children in South Sudan, when I met them, they all have goals about being professionals. And they take Jock's words very seriously. And it may take...
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some women in Yei River State are accusing some NGO officials of demanding for sex in exchange for employment. The acting chairperson of the Yei River State Relief and Rehabilitation Commission confirms his office has received complaints about NGO officials demanding sex from potential female employees. Daniel Friday Martin has this story for VOA from Yei Town.
A 30-year-old woman who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of retribution from NGO officials say a human resource manager at an international NGO in Yei River State denied her a job after she refused his sexual advances. Speaking in Arabic, the woman says many young women looking for jobs are exploited by certain NGO officials and do not report it to authorities because they are afraid they will be fired.
The first thing he told me was that before he would give me a job offer, he wanted to have sex with me. And if I deny him sex for the job offer, the job would be given to another female applicant. If such employers doesn't change, many of the young graduates who are looking for jobs will be subjected to sexual exploitation. At the current employment sector, some of the female workers without qualifications have been employed through sex.
The woman who says she has a degree in accounting told South Sudan in Focus she applied for another job vacancy at another NGO but faced similar treatment. She says she has given up applying for jobs with NGOs and now works in retail trade to try to meet her family's needs. Mary Boka, a local women rights activist, condemns the sexual exploitation and harassment of South Sudanese women by certain NGO officials. She says many professional women cannot get jobs in South Sudan because they refuse to give in to sexual harassment and abuse.
Many women are in the houses sitting with their diploma, with their certificates, simply because of this abuse, the members of the parliament, both in the states and nationally. Let them advocate for us. Let them also mention these things during their sittings. Let them also pass some laws. Actually, we need protection.
Another women rights activist working for EA-based NGO Voice for Change, who wants to be identified only as Amude, for security reasons, confirms that women are being sexually harassed by certain male employers within NGOs.
The woman may not perform in the office, and this gives her stress in her workplace, and she may not perform anything at the workplace. And then at home, she may live also in trauma with her husband. We really want to see forward that women are given rights to different partners, local, whether international. We really urge that they really respect the women and give women the work according to the papers that they have performed in the school.
Obed Taban, acting head of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Yei River State, confirmed some NGO officials have sexually abused South Sudanese women during the recruitment process.
This issue has come to my desk several times, and then mostly I attended a case that the recruitment was done in exploitation of sex. And then these are issues that we actually discourage. The NGOs all have avoided the office of RRC in witnessing the issue of recruitment so that they can recruit people on their interests and then exploit our ladies.
We are going to enforce actually the regulations of the NGO Act
so as to be followed by the NGOs.
Taban says his office is following a court case in which one official working for an international NGO operating in Yei offered one woman a job in return for sex. Mustafa Adam, chairperson of the Yei Civil Society Organizations Forum, says NGOs who exploit female employees are breaking the law.
All the NGOs, including civil society organization, we have code of conduct that regulate us not to practice things related to sexual assaults, things related to sexual abuses. Because the law of South Sudan, especially the labor law, talks about equal representation in a recruitment. A woman who applies needs to be considered based on the merit.
Victoria Nasra, Director General in the State Ministry of Gender and Social Development, urges female workers in the NGO sector to come forward if they have ever been sexually harassed or abused by their supervisors.
We in the government, we strongly condemn that. If you look for a job and if the boss say that he wanted you first for sex before giving you the job, please refuse and report to the Ministry of Gender, Child and Social Welfare or to the police, because we don't want women to be demoralized in their participation or giving service to the people.
South Sudan's labor laws prohibit sexual misconduct, including harassment and exploitation of any and all employees. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
Some South Sudanese civil society activists say South Sudan's budget, recently approved by lawmakers, will not meet the needs of citizens or enable service delivery. The activists are also criticizing the members of parliament for approving the purchase of a presidential jet. Lasuba Memo has more for VOA from Juba.
The 208 billion South Sudanese pound budget approved by parliament last week is much larger than last year's 126 billion South Sudanese pound budget. The budget includes a 77 billion South Sudanese pound deficit, which the finance ministry claims will be covered by the expected difference between the benchmark and actual market price of oil sales. Malice John Peter, executive director of the Juba-based Institute of Social Policy and Research, says even though the budget is larger than last year's, lawmakers made drastic reductions in service delivery expenditures. Initial allocations for general and higher education ministries was slated to be more than 1.1 billion South Sudanese pounds. In the final budget, education received only 976 million South Sudanese pounds, and the health sector was slated to 92 million South Sudanese pounds out of the originally proposed 618 million South Sudanese pounds. Malice says the MPs cut health and education budgets to cover the 1 billion South Sudanese pound cost of the presidential jet and lawmakers' health allowances.
We have seen reduction in budgets of the Minister of Health, Minister of Education, the Water and Urban Cooperation. And you ask yourself, when are we going to start implementing some of the things we want to achieve in the National Development Strategy? When you look at the element of poverty reduction and educational hunger, the Ministry of Agriculture has no capital investment.
Malice questions why the government would pay for a presidential jet at the time when it says it does not have enough money to finance implementation of the peace agreement.
The pre-transitional period security arrangements cannot move forward because the government claims they don't have money. And here we are already budgeting millions of dollars for procuring a presidential jet, which is a good plan. Giving insurance for MPs, which is not a bad idea, but is it the right time for this? And if the National Development Strategy emphasizes the need to silence guns and bring back stability and peace in this country, those are wrong priorities.
The budget allocates $50,000 for each MP's medical allowance. Wani Michael, executive director for the Africa OK Foundation, says that allocation clearly indicates MPs are focused on taking care of themselves rather than serving the South Sudanese people.
If the MPs are insuring themselves, what about our citizens? Who is going to insure us? If we MPs are insuring themselves, what about the citizens who cannot even afford, you know, to treat this simple sickness like malaria and the rest? You know, so you really ask yourself, is this budget meant for the citizens, or this budget is meant for few people.
One also questions the government's ability to finance its programs since the new fiscal year began last month.
Now we are in what? We are in August, going to September. That means government is spending money on whose account? Because our financial year ended on the 30th of June, where they really won. And we even don't feel the budget, because citizen priority has not been taken care of.
Malise and Wane are both calling on government agencies to be more transparent in their expenditures. When lawmakers approved the budget last week, they noted some government institutions acknowledged they overspent their budget allocations on salaries, but actually overspent on office maintenance, something the activists identified as corruption. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
The parents of late Christopher Allen are searching for answers 2 years after their son was killed covering South Sudan's conflict in Kaya on the South Sudan-Uganda border. As Ayen Dingbiu reports from Washington, they were one step closer on Monday when, for the first time, they met with South Sudan's top diplomat in Washington.
Well, you couldn't get the star in
John Allen and Joyce Krajian, parents of the late Christopher Allen, step off the third-floor elevator in the building where South Sudan's embassy is located in Washington, D.C. Allen and Krajian have a letter addressed to Philip Jada Natana, South Sudan's ambassador to the U.S. They insist on personally delivering it, hoping to look him in the eye and ask for accountability. They have become used to walking into corridors of power, from the United Nations to the U.S. State Department, to demand a thorough and independent investigation into the death of the 26-year-old British-American journalist. But this would be the first time that they meet face-to-face with a South Sudanese official about their son's death. As they wait for the ambassador, Krajian is reminded of her son, who she says has emboldened her to act.
Chris's spirit was rather... He was undaunted. He met challenges head on. And as a result of this incident, to be in a position of advocacy, we've done bold things. Like even meeting our senator a year and a half ago felt bold. Going to the UN and meeting the person who reports directly to the Secretary General. That felt bold.
The Columbia Journalism Review reports Allen was killed the morning of August 26th, 2 years ago, in Kaya, South Sudan, near the northwest border of Uganda, while covering a rebel offenses. Circumstances surrounding his death are still unclear. Reporters Without Borders, known by its French acronym RSF, and its partners are calling for an independent investigation. They say his death could amount to war crimes. Pictures of Allen's lifeless body flooded social media shortly after his death. The family accuses government officials of sharing those pictures, which they say humiliated their son and were degrading and undignified, according to Doki Fasian, the executive director of RSF's North America Bureau. There's also credible evidence to suggest Allen was deliberately targeted as a journalist, she says, another potential war crime. Daphne Pellegrino, RSF's North America advocacy manager, says South Sudan has not done enough to bring accountability and justice to Allen.
And it means that Christopher Allen was killed with impunity, and this is absolutely unacceptable, and we are very adamant that the South Sudanese government conduct a thorough investigation into this killing and is accountable for their actions, both in the killing of Christopher Allen and in the aftermath.
Ambassador Philip Jada Natana, a former journalist himself, took a meeting with the family, which lasted about 10 minutes in the lobby of the embassy. He gave his condolences to Allen's mother and father, but distanced the government from any responsibility for his death.
We tried as a government to investigate, but the fact remained that for a very long time, we were not able to complete the investigation, you know, given the fact that, you know, how he came into the country, he didn't come actually through the, you know, the main town and through the main airport and so on, so that we could see, because that becomes our responsibility once he enters and goes into that, you know.
Adete Akwe, Amnesty International's Deputy Director of Advocacy and Government Relations, thinks the reluctance on the government side in allowing an independent investigation is strategic on their end.
I think the government doesn't feel obligated to do that. I think that they are determined to prevent any narratives that they don't like coming up and being exposed. They are, until they actually feel consequences about failing to be accountable or to clean up their act and respect human rights, there's not going to be any change in this kind of behavior. So they don't want any questions and they're not going to investigate.
Courtney Raj, the Committee to Protect Journalists Advocacy Director, won't back down from demanding an independent investigation.
Justice looks like an investigation, a meaningful investigation into who was responsible and then how to prevent future killings like that. So we know that there are journalists killed in crossfire. This was a very complicated case, and you certainly cannot achieve any form of justice if you don't have the basic facts about what happened. So the first step towards any form of justice is an investigation.
The meeting between Alan's parents and South Sudan's U.S. ambassador took place in the backdrop of a vigil held minutes before the meeting took place. The family held a parallel vigil in London yesterday as well. Ayan Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
An American filmmaker has produced a documentary about her recent experience in Juba's suburb of Gumbo, where she witnessed children attending classes in a new secondary school established by a Mandela Washington fellow. Gil Prinsky tells VOA's intern David Monodanga that Jock Abraham wanted to build the school to achieve his mission of changing minds from bullets to books.
He believes that it's through education that he can achieve this. And I must tell you that the response of the children in South Sudan when I met them, they all have goals about being professionals. And they take Jock's words very seriously. And it may take two generations, but they're the ones that are going to be able to tell their grandkids, we started this. And it's going to really be important for them to share the stories about how they progressed and followed Jock's idea about unity, peace, and leadership.
I am sure before you went to South Sudan, you had these expectations. How did the exchange program change your perspective?
Well, we didn't know how we were going to get to Juba. We had this idea of filming a documentary and to help Jock realize some plans that he had for the Promised Land Secondary School. Currently, we are producing a short version of a documentary film that covers our time in Juba in June. And during that time, we had done workshops to explore issues of oppression and response through music and art, a filmmaking techniques program for budding documentary filmmakers in Juba, and to start filming around the story of Jock's school, the Promised Land Secondary School, and Jock's mission, which is changing minds from bullets to books. Our next phase will be bringing Jock back to the United States, where he will talk about his mission, changing minds from bullets to books.
I am sure you went through some challenges in South Sudan.
Yes, I would say primarily security was a huge issue. The U.S. Embassy took very good care of us. However, they restricted our physical movements. We were not allowed to go wherever we wanted. We were allowed to go to the U.S. Embassy residence and to Jock's school. And we always had a bodyguard when we went to Jock's school. And we were in vehicles that I understand cost something like $400,000 that were armed. So it was very frustrating for us. We also had restrictions that even on the premises, we were staying at the Rainbow Hotel. We had to have media permits wherever we went because taking pictures, interviewing people threatens the authorities in Juba.
Did you feel insecure And will you recommend someone to go to South Sudan for such programs and why?
I didn't feel insecure because, again, the U.S. Embassy took great care in making sure that we were always okay. I've been asked recently by some people that want to go to South Sudan. I think that if they go outside of Juba, it's more risky. If they stay in Juba, it's probably okay. But I think that, for instance, one person wants to take pictures, they need to make sure they get a media permit. That is absolutely necessary.
Do you have any long-term plans, like going back to South Sudan to conduct more trainings? On which areas will you focus on more?
So we have this online workshop going on right now with the filmmakers, and I would love to go back at some point and work with them again in location, because I'm kind of envious of the stories that they're producing, and I want to be at the interviews to be a part of that. We have more ideas as far as with the musicians to do a number of different programs that hopefully will be cabaret songs and other American kind of songs that will be require coaching.
Summarize what you learned from the filmmakers in South Sudan.
They have worked in creative ways, but never in documentary filmmaking, and yet they have stories to tell. And again, it's very difficult because there aren't many resources right now in South Sudan for film equipment, for sound equipment. What we're doing right now is working with what there is, and I hope that over time people will help and provide equipment, either used equipment or will help buy equipment, because they have amazing stories to tell. For instance, we're working right now on a story about a girl child soldier. We're working about the issue of marriage very young for girls and what the issues are with that.
That's Jill Prinsky, a U.S. documentary filmmaker, speaking to VOA intern David Monodanga about a secondary school established by Mandela fellow Jock Abraham. The program received its funding from the U.S. State Department. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the effects of tobacco on your health. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how much is music a part of your life?
Not really. I like music in my free time. So when I'm so busy, I don't. I'm not so addicted, yet I love it. Like in the evening when I'm done with my work.
Music does a lot to me. I would say most of my life duty or day duties, music is one of them. Before I go to sleep, the first thing I think of is the music.
It's the language of everyone. When everyone listens to music, it's the language of dancing.
Oh my God, it's really wonderful. I like music so much because if you're so talented in music, you'll have very many ways of feeling in your life. For example, music can take stress away from your heart.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America, and it's time for our Tuesday Health segment. Today we are talking about the effects of tobacco. The World Health Organization is urging nations to implement a series of cost-effective anti-tobacco measures it says will help their populations quit smoking. A WHO report finds progress in combating the tobacco epidemic. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
A survey finds 36 countries have introduced one or more measures aimed at helping people quit smoking. Only Turkey and Brazil have implemented all of WHO's recommended anti-tobacco measures. These include graphic images on cigarette packages, warning of the dangers of smoking, banning tobacco advertising and promotion, and raising taxes on tobacco products. While this is progress, it is far too little to stop the global tobacco epidemic that each year prematurely kills more than 8 million people, 80% of them in developing countries. Program manager of WHO's Tobacco Control Unit, Vinayak Prasad, accuses the tobacco industry of being devious and finding new ways to hinder progress. He says the industry is reinventing itself in hopes of shedding its bad reputation and regaining legitimacy.
So that's one of the reasons that many countries are finding it difficult to make progress, because the industry has gone into creating new and novel products and pushing the governments to have less regulatory compliances. And that's a problem in all regions of the world.
Pressa says the tobacco industry has come up with several smoking alternatives it claims are less dangerous than cigarettes. However, he notes the new heated tobacco products are the same as cigarettes, except they do not emit any smoke. He says electronic cigarettes do not contain tobacco, but do have nicotine. He says there is no evidence that e-cigarettes help people quit.
The evidence in the U.S., for example, is that they were liberal to open the market for electronic cigarettes for almost like 7-8 years. In one stroke, they have seen an increase in youth tobacco in the last 3 years, where the youth is starting to see, oh, this is safer, this is nice, let's take it, and then move on to tobacco. So it's also a gateway for young people.
The World Health Organization warns tobacco has a huge health and economic cost. It says cigarettes are the number one risk factor for cardiovascular disease, cancers, and respiratory diseases. It says the cost to the world economy is $1.4 trillion, or nearly 2% of global gross domestic product. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That report by Lisa Schlein brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Cry for Peace by Vivian Chan. Been listening to Vivian Chan singing about peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.